Good afternoon. Welcome to Open Air. I'm Kevin Vance, sitting in for David LaTulipe. We'll be talking about the world premiere of a great piece about humanity. We'll be talking about one of Duke Ellington's musicians having a love affair with somebody on tour in Iran. We'll be talking about books and other foolish things and more here on Open Air. Stay tuned. I'm pleased to introduce to the KLW studios Robert Geary and... Sorry. Pardon me, I'll be right back. Robert Geary and Stacey Garup are our guests here in the KLW studio. Good afternoon, folks. Yeah, absolutely. So we're working. There's a particular event that we want to point people's attention to. One of them is a performance of a piece of Handel's, as well as the world premiere of a piece of Stacey Garup's. Can we talk about the Handel first, Robert?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, if for all the fans of Handel's great works, maybe Messiah comes first to mind for kind of his choral works. I would say if you haven't yet heard Dixit Dominus, in this piece you will actually hear his greatest choral writing, as well as some wonderful solos, but it really the choral writing's outstanding. He wrote the piece when he was a young man. He was in Italy, so this is before his long tenure in England when he did most of his oratorio writing. And this is a 40-minute work in seven movements that's just brilliant. His compositional invention is inspiring. So I've worked on the piece a few times over the years, and every time I go back to it, it's like, you know, I looked at Brian Baker, Dr. Baker, our accompanist and associate director, and I said, do you think that this is his greatest choral writing? And he's like, hands down. So if you love Handel and you like choral music, come hear this. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah. When did he write this? Was it before or after Messiah? That's sort of a marker point.
It was before Messiah.
Way before Messiah.
He was a young man. I mean, he was in his, I think, early 20s when he wrote this.
Where's the libretto? Where's the text from?
Dixit Dominus is actually a psalm setting. So it's, you know, Old Testament stuff, old book. Pretty dramatic text, which, of course, works well musically. We're not suffering fools lightly, let's put it that way.
Okay. A performance of Handel's Dixit Dominus happening put on by members of the San Francisco Choral Society. And the dates for that is Saturday the 25th and Sunday the 26th, just those two performances, right?
Yeah. I might just say that there's a church that we perform at occasionally, but not that often, which is St. Paul out at Valley and Church. And what's cool about that church is it's not such a well-known venue. It's really a gorgeous building, so fun to experience the building itself. And it for those of us old enough to have seen Whoopi Goldberg in the Sister Act, it's where they filmed the Sister Act.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, yeah. Oh, well then.
Yeah, it's fun.
I'll bet it sounds gorgeous in there, too.
Yeah, it's a nice space. Very nice space.
The other voice that you hear here in the background is that of the composer Stacey Garup. And in addition to this performance of Handel's Dixit Dominus, will be the world premiere of her piece called The Rise of Humanity. Stacey, welcome to KLW.
It's great to be here.
Tell me about the piece, The Rise of Humanity.
Well, this is part two of an oratorio that's called Terra Nostra. So the first part was called Creation of the World. The next one, this is the part we're on now, The Rise of Humanity. Part three, I'm actually still working out a title for that one, so to be announced at a later date. But this particular part one was about really texts about the creation of the world. I featured texts from India and Egypt and North America and about creation myths. So after the world was created, then there's a celebration of the planet, and that was done through some texts by Edna St. Vincent Millay and Percy Shelley. Walt Whitman was also getting a good dose dose of representation in that part one. And now we're on to part two. So after part one, which is all about the creation of the world, I wanted part two to speak about the triumphs of humanity. So you're going to hear texts about looking forward to the future, the creation of railways, of steam engine. And then my favorite text is the one about the creation of airplanes, which is High Flight by John Gillespie McGee Jr. And then after that, the texts start to turn dark. We're seeing what the result of these the triumphs are doing to the actual planet. So this is followed by a poem called Binsey Poplars by Gerard Manley Hopkins, as well as a dirge by Percy Shelley again. And part three, which is tentatively called Searching for Balance, among other titles, focuses on texts that are really about seeing just how much more the world is getting in out of balance. So we have poems by Lord Byron, a contemporary poet named Esther Ivram, and then one by William Wordsworth. But then the crux of the whole oratorio comes down to Wendell Berry's The Want of Peace. So this is where I feel like the message is, if we, humanity, really care about the planet, we can try to pay attention to the planet, find a way to live within what was being offered by the planet. And all the texts from there on out are Walt Whitman to show us how we can relate back to the planet.
Oh, my. This sounds gorgeous. It sounds wonderful. And it sounds moving, too. I want to play for people an example of some of your music, since this is a world premiere. We certainly don't have any recordings of this new piece that we're premiering. However, we're going to listen to a piece, Now by This Moon. Could you tell me the story behind this?
So Now by This Moon is a sonnet by Edna St. Vincent Millay. She's one of my favorite poets to set. And this particular one, this is a woman who is really wants a man. And she's basically saying, I'm going to want you now or in your grave. Take your pick. So one way or another, I'm going to have you.
Piece called Now by This Moon, Before This Moon Shall Wane, from the Sonnets of Desire, Longing, and Whimsy by composer Stacy Garup, our guest here on Open Air here on KALW. The world premiere of her piece, one part of a larger piece called Terra Nostra, part two of three of them. It'll be called The Rise of Humanity, the weekend of the 25th and the 26th as well. So this is actually, it's a world premiere in stages. It's three pieces, and we're listening to, and we're about to hear on the 25th and 26th at St. Paul's Catholic Church, the second of the three installments?
Yes. So we did the first installment last November, and this is now installment two, and the final installment will be next November of 2015. Bob, do you know the dates on that?
Not the precise dates. We'll get those out. We do have them. But I would say that it might be fun to review the Choral Society, which is, it bases its repertoire is based in, historical great choral works, has increasingly been reaching out to do some newer and more innovative projects, and including David Lang's battle hymns and bringing some dramatic elements into historical works. But the Choral Society's programming committee decided that it wanted to sponsor an oratorio, which is a large choral work kind of in the tradition, but with a more contemporary theme, and went through a process of selecting Stacy because of her originality and there's dramatic integrity to her music and a very good use of vocal. She understands the human voice really well, so she writes in a way that singers really enjoy working on her music and audiences can really hear what she's going after. And she's an accomplished composer for orchestra as well. So we have a happy relationship. And then with an organization like the Choral Society, somebody doesn't suddenly give you $100,000 and say, why don't you put this oratorio on? So we had to figure out a way to phase it in. And that's our... we're enjoying doing this in kind of these three stages, and Stacy's coming out for each of the stages to coach us and work with us and all of that.
Robert Geary, the artistic director at San Francisco Choral Society, we're also here with the composer, Stacy. Oh, sorry. Pardon me.
Garup.
I'm sorry. How embarrassing. I'm interested to know, Stacy, about... how long you've been a composer, and what it's like for somebody from a rock and roll generation to be to be composing 20th and 21st century classical music.
Well, I grew up in the Bay Area. I'm from here. I went to Monta Vista High School, and it was at Monta Vista that I took a music theory class, where the teacher said, go home and write a piece of music. And I had never thought about being a composer until that very moment. And even then, it was probably another year before I started taking it seriously. But I didn't really have the classical upbringing that a lot of composers typically have. What I had done is listened to a lot of rock and roll, and my parents took me to a lot of musical theater. And I suspect there's some element of that, all that musical theater, especially West Side Story, that got really nailed into my brain. And maybe that's why I get so dramatic with everything that I do. And I'm happy about that. I think it's not a bad thing at all to have that kind of dramatic flair about the music that I write.
You've written all kinds of things. You've written oratorios and string quartets and everything.
Yeah, I have a mythology symphony at this point. I have four string quartets, many piano trios. And a lot for choir, huge amounts for choir, because I sang in choirs ever since I was in grade school, all the way through through my master's program. But I still feel like for me, writing for singers is always the closest thing to my heart. It's the thing that makes the most sense. And it's hard to explain, but sometimes when you're dealing with an oratorio, you've got four soloists and you've got two choirs and you've got an orchestra, and you have to keep all those things in your head at once. And that can be a little bit challenging, but when I'm writing just for choir, I don't even have to think about it. It feels like so natural. So I feel the same way about string quartets, ironically, because I didn't play any string instruments, but for some reason that really appeals to me too.
What was your first instrument?
It was piano. I sang and played piano, and then I played saxophone, so I actually have a lot of works for saxophone as well.
Excellent. Stacy Garup, the composer of The Rise of Humanity, part two of a three-part oratorio. It's an oratorio. It's
yes.
A proper oratorio called Terra Nostra. The world premiere of that being performed on Saturday the 25th and Sunday the 26th, both at 8 p.m. at St. Paul's Catholic Church, 211 Valley Street at Church in Noe Valley, a presentation of San Francisco Choral Society, along with the performance of George Frideric Handel's Dixit Dominus. And our guests have been Stacy Garup, as well as Artistic Director Robert Geary. Folks, thank you so much. We're looking forward to it. And I understand tickets are available from the City Box Office at telephone number 415-392-4400. You can go to sfchoral.org as well as cityboxoffice.com. Anything I'm leaving out?
No, thanks, Kevin. But I will say November 13th and 14th. next November. We'll let you know later about that, too.
Next November, we'll hear part three of this oratorio.
All three parts together.
All three parts together. Yeah. Excellent. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin.
A little bit of Handel played for choral music, and just to remind you that San Francisco Choral Society performing the music of Handel as well as the music of Gerup the final weekend of April. You can go to sfchoral.org. It is open air here on KALW San Francisco, klw.org, and welcome back to the KALW microphones. Matt Hanscom, who's going to be singing one of the parts in Opera San Jose's production of Mozart's Magic Flute. Matt, welcome to KLW.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
What part are you playing?
My part is Papageno. He's the sort of royal bird catcher employed by the Queen of the Night.
Oh, okay. So we get to see you with the little at the very beginning of
He is proficient in the panpipes, that's right. That's how he lures his birds towards him so he can catch them. In this particular production, I have a spectacular sort of bird-flavored hat and coat. So it's all very interesting, and a lot of man hours went into making it, and it's a joy to take the stage with it on every day.
How long have you been working on this?
This production, let's see. I guess it's about 7 weeks at this point.
Mm.
Production period is, I think, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, and then the performances begin.
Okay.
So one of the benefits of Opera San Jose is that we get a good amount of time to work all of the details dramatically in the room before we head to the stage.
Fantastic. Opera San Jose, their production of the Magic Flute. A little Mozart for beginners. What goes on in the Magic Flute?
The action revolves around Prince Tamino, who, all we know about him is that he's a wanderer from a faraway land, and he finds himself in the land of the Queen of the Night and Zoroastro, where there's this sort of struggle for power going on between Zoroastro, who's the keeper of the sun, and the Queen of the Night. And he's looking for true love. And it just so happens that there's a princess named Pamina, who is perfect for him, except that she's been kidnapped by an evil agent of the Queen of the Night named Monastatos. And, Zoroastro works as hard as he can to get those two under his power. They go into the temple, and he has to prove himself by undergoing trials of fire and water. And if he can succeed in these trials, he'll end up with the love of his life. And no spoilers, because obviously you can find these things out, but it all works out pretty well in the end.
This is one of those operas that has a happy ending.
Absolutely.
It's one of those... was it designed for children, or was it sort of the equivalent of a musical comedy?
Not designed for children.
Rom-com, yes.
Right, not designed for children originally. In these days, it's often produced as such because it's a great opera for family to get to make your first opera to bring your kids to. It's not really violent or, some of the crazy plots that we all know exist in opera. But... not originally designed for children, no.
Mm-hmm. Well, this production will be somewhat kid appropriate,
of course. And there are even children in the production. We have a whole corps de ballet of dancing children who are integral to the action. They puppeteer like the dragon in the first act. They puppeteer the birds during my first aria. They do amazing amounts of choreography that make my head spin. And there are three singing genies who are angelic voiced boys. I believe they're from an organization called the San Francisco Boys Choir. I don't know if that really exists. They said something to that effect to me, and they sing beautifully. And it's all about the pureness of the harmony with a boy soprano voice like that. So they're fantastic.
Oh boy, this is Matthew Hanscom. He's the baritone and playing the part of what is the character's name again?
Papageno.
Papageno. That's right. There's that pa-pa-pa-pa thing at the very end.
Yes, the duet with Papageno. Yes, Papageno and the love of his life happens to be Papagena. So
how convenient.
Yes, exactly.
Magic Flute, Mozart's great opera being performed by Opera San Jose. The dates I have here are April 18th. Oh, my God, that was yesterday. Yeah.
Tonight.
Tonight. There's a performance tonight. April 18th through May 3rd, and it's taking place at the California Theater. The address is 345 South 1st Street in San Jose. And a website to go to is operasj.org. There's something special about this performance, the stagecraft of this that's bigger than anybody else's?
Yes, there is. We have the benefit on this production of having the support of the Packard Humanities Foundation. They have generously offered to cover many of the expenses of our production, and from the very first moments of the overture, which is all staged in our production, you will see magnificent, larger-than-life dragons come out on stage, puppeteered by, like I said, the children and some of the chorus members.
Puppeted, absolutely. Oh my gosh.
And sort of really interesting neon light effects, strobe effects. There are mirrored walls. The entire second act is supposed to be, you know, like a negative image of the first act. So it's really supposed to set the audience, you know, sort of topsy-turvy as compared to how they felt sort of stable in the first act. Here we've entered into Zoroastro's temple, and things get a little strange. So there are neon lights, there are mirrored walls, there are strobe effects, there's a lighting effect during the trials of fire and water that bathes the entire audience, the entire house, in sort of waves of fire and water. It's a feast for the eyes as well as the ears.
Even more so than going to the planetarium or seeing one of those IMAX presentations.
Exactly,
it's going to be bigger than IMAX.
It is. It's a surround sound experience for sure.
This is the performance of the Magic Flute, the great opera by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, taking place now through the 3rd of May at the California Theater at 345 South 1st Street, put on by Opera San Jose. Their website is operasj.org. Matthew Hanscom is here talking about that, playing the part of Papageno. I want to make sure I get all the consonants in there properly. I won't make you sing. I usually like making folk singers sing, but I won't make an opera singer sing. And how long have you been doing this?
Opera singing is sort of a gradual process. You don't just do it. But I grew up in Minnesota. And in Minnesota, like many places in the country, I'm sure, but Minnesota particularly has a very rich choral tradition. So I spent every day of my life going to choir, grade school through high school. And in high school, there was a program where voice teachers from St. Olaf College nearby would come and bring a voice teacher, a little group of voice teachers would come, and we could opt out of our choir period that day and take a voice lesson instead. Started studying songs and sort of, you know, introductory arias. And, you know, my first love was musical theater, but at some point my voice became more mature. It had a heavier sound, and it became more suited for opera. And I went to Northwestern and just started studying opera, and I was a double major in economics originally, but music became the only thing that I could see myself doing, so I focused on that, and here we are.
Matthew Hanscom, he's playing the part of Papageno in Mozart's Magic Flute, put on by Opera San Jose. Their website is operasj.org. The performance of the Magic Flute going on now through May 3rd. There's a performance tonight.
Correct.
You need to get back on the BART, head back down to San
6:30,
Jose. 6:30,
that's right, in the chair right. At 6:30.
California Theater in San Jose. The address is 345 South 1st Street in San Jose. A performance tonight, another performance Sunday, next weekend, Friday and Sunday as well?
Correct.
I'm looking forward to seeing this.
Fantastic.
Matthew, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
ihr Vogelfänger bin ich ja stets lustig, heißer Hopsasser, ihr Vogelfänger bin bekannt, bei alt und jung im ganzen Land. Weiß mit dem Locken umzugehen und ihn trotz Feinden zu verstehen. Drum kann ich froh und lustig sein, denn andere Vögel sind ja mein. Der Vogelfänger bin ich ja stets lustig, heißer und sassa, mit Vogelfänger bin bekannt, bei alt und jung im ganzen Land. Ein Netz für Mädchen möchte ich fliegen, sie dutzend weiß für mich. Dann sperrte ich sie bei mir ein und alle Mädchen wären mein. Wenn alle Mädchen wären mein, so tauschte ich nach Zucker ein, die welche mir am liebsten wär, der geb ich gleich den Zucker her. Und küsste sie mit Zärtlichkeit, wär sie mein Weib und ich ihr Mann. Sie schlief an meiner Seite ein,
This is a piece called Isfahan, and this is a Duke Ellington piece, isn't it?
Well, more. Are we on the air? Oh.
Yeah, we are. That's Marcus Shelby, who's doing the music behind a wonderful play that I'm really looking forward to telling you all about. It's called Isfahan Blues, and Marcus Shelby, one of the great treasures of Bay Area jazz, is here to talk about it because he's musically contributing to it. Mm-hmm. So, tell me the story of at least the Isfahan.
Oh, we're listening to. Well, yeah, this is actually a piece called Isfahan, mm-hmm. and it was more specifically composed by Billy Strayhorn. And you know, there's a lot of history behind this piece because it's associated with Duke Ellington's perennials record, I was going to call it a CD, but album that he released in the mid-60s called The Far East Suite.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually should have been called The Middle East Suite, because they traveled all through the Middle East, mostly places like Jordan, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran. That's where Isfahan is actually located. And through this was a State Department tour, mm-hmm. meaning that the United States State Department sent them out kind of on a goodwill tour to display some of the sort of talent and power and sort of democratic ideals of the country by sending this well-known artist, Duke Ellington, out to visit different countries and to show America's sort of democratic prowess, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So not only did they go there, Dizzy Gillespie went a couple places, Louis Armstrong went on a number of State Department tours. So it was kind of a popular thing at a time when the United States were really trying to show the strength of the freedom of democracy. Problem was, it was a major contradiction, because back home you had segregation.
Oh, yeah.
So it was hypocritical to send black musicians out on the road, but at home they couldn't eat at the same restaurants as other people could. And so this was a concerning point, not only for Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington, but also Louis Armstrong and Dizzy Gillespie. And so the play actually touches on that, Isfahan Blues. This play that we're opening May 2nd, actually, the content of the play actually talks about the social struggles in Iran, kind of pre-revolution and you know, this time period in the early 60s. And
people becoming dissatisfied with the Shah. Yeah.
Exactly. And then sort of the similarities that are happening in the United States in the 60s at the same time. So this song, Isfahan, that we just heard, written by Billy Strayhorn, performed by the Duke Ellington Orchestra, is about Isfahan. And, you know, if you've been following Isfahan in the news over the last 10 years, you know this is a very important place Iran.
I'm told by a friend of mine who lived in Iran, she wasn't there, but she said Isfahan is just the most beautiful city.
Yeah.
It's like the Paris of the Persian Empire.
Yeah, it's progressive from what I understand, but it also is a very important city there. And it was back in, you know, for as long as Iran has been there. And it's a central place in the play, Isfahan Blues. But Billy Strayhorn had already composed this piece. It was called Elf, before they even went to the Middle East.
Mm.
And it was a sketch. But they were looking for music that really evoked and captured their essence of their experience in these different countries. Even Ellington and Billy Strayhorn said themselves, they weren't trying to create Middle Eastern sound in music. They wanted to create music within their own sort of musical language, blues and swing, but have the impressions of the sound, the melodies, the harmonic impressions. They have a piece called Depk on this record. That's about a Palestinian dance.
I know what a Depka is. Yes, yes.
They have
a very jumpy little piece.
And this piece jumps. Da da ba da 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 da. Yeah, it's like a child dance.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also a piece on there called Mount Harissa, which is a beautiful sort of sweeping composition that captures this great mountain. There's a piece in there called Tourist Point of View, and it's about walking through the marketplace in the Middle East and seeing all the various things that happen in a marketplace, the people selling items and goods, the sounds of the various music, the colorful and the smells of a marketplace. And that composition kind of captures that, but in the language of blues and swing.
Mm.
So that, you know, Isfahan has that too. You know, you kind of imagine the beauty of the city through this tone poem that Billy Strayhorn wrote.
This is all about the world premiere of the play Isfahan Blues, and this is being put on by members of the African American Shakespeare Company. Happy birthday, William Shakespeare, incidentally. And Golden Thread Productions. Marcus Shelby is here, and he's contributed to this production musically. And let me just tell people that it's taking place at these performances of this play of Isfahan Blues is taking place at the Burial Clay Theater. May 2nd through the 24th of May as well. Friday and Saturdays at 8 p.m. and a Sunday matinee at 3 p.m. There's a website, I want to say African-American Shakespeare. I think if you Google African-American Shakespeare Company or Golden Thread Productions,
yeah,
you'll be able to find all this.
Certainly.
The story, I understand the story, in addition to African-American musicians traveling around the world, that there's a fictitious story of a character based on Billy Strayhorn falling in love with somebody, with a local in Isfahan?
Well, this story about Duke Ellington's band being on this tour, you know, this really happened in 1963. They went to all these different places. They also went to Iran. Where our story kind of connects is that Taranj, the playwright, she, her parents owned a jazz club in Iran in 1963. They don't know. I'm sure they would have known if Duke Ellington came to the club. But the play is really about the possibility or the fictitious experience of Duke Ellington's band hanging out at this club. But Billy Strayhorn is the one who actually, the central character in our play, he's called Ray Hamilton. Visits this club in Iran in 1963 that Taranj's parents owned, makes a strong connection with Taranj's mother, Bella. Now, Bella was an actress at the time, one of the most famous actresses in Iran. True story. This is Taranj's mother. And in our play, Bella is actually Taranj's mother is playing an older Bella, and they're reminiscing what happened during this time period.
Oh.
So we actually have Bella, Taranj's mom, who plays her older self, Ray Hamilton, a.k.a. Billy Strayhorn. They met at this club, and there was a young musician that was playing at the club as part of the Black Cats was the name of the band, and there is a connection between Ray Hamilton, Billy Strayhorn, and this young musician. I can't tell you too much after that.
No, no. Yeah. God, we have to see it. I mean,
because
see
it's more than just sort of this passing flirtation, because all of this sort of connection of each other's culture, of each other's understanding of the other's culture, and the commonalities that exist between them really play out. And so, but there is this attraction. There's no secret that Billy Strayhorn was gay, and that Duke Ellington, in a sense, I don't want to say protected him, but gave him this sense of a safe zone to create music, to do exactly what he wanted to do, right, and not have to deal with the scrutiny of being a young black gay man in New York in 1938. That's when he met Duke Ellington. And so Duke Ellington really allowed Billy Strayhorn to have this vital life as a composer. He had the best band in the world to write for, the Ellington Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So he was being recorded. They were touring. They were playing his arrangements and his compositions. And he could live his life as he wanted to. And he lived a pretty open life, you know, not maybe publicly in the sort of public conscious, but it's well documented that he had lovers, and that he had and that he was part of that community, at least amongst musicians, composers and arrangers and the whole art community in New York. And so this is important to understand, because he was able to, in a way, be out at a time when even just being black was being, meaning you had challenges, you know, in the workplace.
Marcus Shelby here. He's a musical contributor, musical director of this this production. It is a play called Isfahan Blues. It's written by Turanga Yegazarian.
Taranj.
But that was good. I practiced it all morning. But it's a fascinating story, yeah. And it's being presented by the African American Shakespeare Company and Golden Thread Productions. The place will be the Burial Clay Theater, May 2nd through May 24th. Friday and Saturday performances at 8 p.m., a Sunday matinee at 3 p.m. And you can Google search African American Shakespeare Company or Golden Thread Productions for more information. What did you have to do? Did you use any of the original Duke Ellington pieces that he did, or did you have to compose your own?
I had to write all new music for it because we did not have the permission to use Ellington.
Too bad.
Yeah, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. One is, yeah, it is kind of too bad because it's a treasure trove of masterpieces of one that you can use. So that was going to be our original approach, is to, I'm a composer, but I'm also an arranger. So it was going to be this opportunity to work with Ellington and Strayhorn's compositions, both challenging, intimidating, perhaps shouldn't even be thought of as an attempt to do, but it was, you know, it was going to be that sort of exercise. And then when we found out we couldn't even use the music, then it kind of actually freed us up to take an original approach, to use original music, and we were able to kind of go into some different directions. It didn't mean I had to produce music, and it had to have a certain authenticity that was connected to the Ellington repertoire and sound. But I'll say, you know, Ellington has been someone... The music of Ellington, the world of Ellington, is something that I've been very interested in a long time. It's had a strong impression on me and inspiration on why I started a big band in 15 years ago. And it was really to learn his music. It was to learn how to write music. It was to be able to play Ellington and Strayhorn's music. So this opportunity to create music about a story about Ellington is something that you can only dream of if that has been part of your journey, you know. And it's been great because the story that Taranj has written is great and it's wonderful, and it involves history and it involves musicians and composers who I deeply love. Look, my daughter's name is Kennedy, named after Duke Ellington.
Of course.
And my other daughter's name is Billy, named after Billy Strayhorn.
Oh, uh-huh.
And Billy Holiday.
And Billy Holiday.
And Billy Strayhorn. And Billy Higgins.
Oh,
so
yes.
So that sort of triumvirate of Billy's. So I'd have to say that Ellington is someone I dearly love and quite influenced by. And so I'm glad that this opportunity came to kind of be able to try to create music for that world.
The play is Isfahan Blues. It's in performance May 2nd through the 24th of the month of May. It's taking place at the Burial Clay Theater, and it's being put on by Golden Thread Productions as well as the African American Shakespeare Company. And our guest here for this quarter hour of open air is the great Marcus Shelby, whose music I've been admiring for many years, and honored and a privilege to meet you, Marcus.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Peter Robinson will be here to talk about books and some foolish things, other foolish things, here on Open Air. Thank you, Marcus.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you.
welcome back Peter Robinson to the KLW microphones. Peter, hello. How are you?
Good to be here, Kevin Langon. You've gone the full range today, from the magic flute to rewriting Duke Ellington. Can you get that all in 45 minutes? Well, you did it, and well done. And I was just thinking, as we were playing one of my favourites, These Foolish Things, is that I was walking into Books Inc. on Opera Plaza, and there are some apartments above there. The window was open, and I literally did hear a tinkling piano. Because I always think of the opening lines, you know, a cigarette that burns those lipstick traces, an airline ticket to romantic places, and there was the tinkling piano. But also, These Foolish Things, amongst the foolish things I do, is browse in bookstores. And there is something both peaceful and meditative about wandering along the shelves of books and almost serendipitously being guided to a title or an author. And then you see what is next to that author or that title on the shelf. So I'm a believer in serendipity, in little moments of discovery, when you find something which intuitively knew in your subconscious you were looking for, but was hidden away. I find it different to browsing on the net. Now, talking about bookstores, in the last 10 or 15 years, we've seen a lot of the landscape of bookstores change, often, sadly, here in the Bay Area. We've seen Clean Well Lighted go, and then more recently, the chain Borders go. So I'm a believer in making do with what we've got. And one of the group which I'll spend a few minutes talking about is Books Inc. It's one of the oldest collection of bookstores in the Bay Area. And in today's world, bookstores actually fulfill a valuable social function that goes much further than simply selling books. So if you take the one I mentioned, Books Inc. at Opera Plaza, you can join, and it's totally open, a drop-in type thing, the World Affairs Council Book Club. It meets every fourth Sunday from 11 till 12, and they are primarily interested in current affairs. If you move up to Laurel Village, there's another Books Inc. there, and they have a group known as Women We'd Like to Lunch With Book Club. And this chooses titles where the protagonist is a woman and the issues that are concerned relate to women. And that meets on the first Tuesday every month at 7 p.m. in the evening. So already we see that bookstores are performing a social function, bringing people together who, like many KLW listeners, are readers. I know this because people call and ask, what should they take on holiday? In the Marina, Books Inc. is down there on Chestnut Street, and they have a series called Classics I Forgot to Read. It's a book club that looks back on everything from Jane Austen forward, and they meet on Sunday. It's every other month at 4 p.m. and it's the second Sunday of every other month, so you get a chance to catch up on those books that were always on the shelf but never actually got taken off. And just one more is Books Inc. over in Berkeley. They are moving from 4th Street to Shattuck and Vine Street later in May, early June, and they'll certainly have a lot of things happening. And that, of course, takes me into what will be a major literary event in the month of June, and it is the Berkeley Book Festival. I highly recommend taking a trip over there because it's just going to be a fun fair of activity. They have over 300 top authors. It's going to be what I call a literary cornucopia, with 150 different exhibitors. And for those who like cooking, and cookbooks now perform a big part of publishers' book sales, there will be leading chefs talking about their cookbooks and serving up exactly what it is you want to eat, fresh, homemade, on-the-spot food. So this is something to look out for. It's a new departure, which brings together readers from across the Bay Area. It's running, as I say, through the beginning of the month of June, and it's a good reason for exploring the back streets of Berkeley and enjoying a whole advent which relates to reading. Now, this time of year, when people are planning a vacation, I have a couple of titles. If you want something to pack in your case or take on the plane or cope with that delay, which always happens at the airport, have a good book to read. My first choice is called The Road to Character. It's by David Brooks, who many people may know from the NewsHour commentary. He commentates with Mark Shields. And it's a really interesting combination of philosophy, psychology, sociology, and I think to some extent spirituality. What he does is distinguish between what you put on your resume and what you hear at your eulogy. So it's two takes on the same person, a sort of dichotomy, a schizophrenic look at who we think we are and who our friends said we are, and more or less everything in between. If you're looking for the thriller for a beach time read, I highly recommend The Lady from Zagreb. It's by the British author Philip Kerr. And this takes us back into wartime Germany. The police investigator is totally anti-Nazi. The Lady from Zagreb is, of course, a film star who ends up working in Dr. Gorbel's film industry. But I won't say any more. You will learn a lot about everything to do with World War II. And while you're on the subject of history, Eric Larson's book, Dead Wake. Dead Wake is the story of the Lusitania, the boat which was torpedoed and in many ways contributed to the American entry into World War II. He has a way of putting you inside the cabin as the boat is sinking. So you get the you are there feeling, a really crisp read. Good with history, good with biography, and for those who enjoy nautical-type stories, this is a classic sinking ship tale. Two very different ones to move away. One is Memoir. It's by Helen MacDonald. It's called H is for Hawk, and that is the sort of hawk that flies around in the sky. It's a beautiful nature book where she started studying the goshawk after her father's death. And it's lyrically written, a great story, even if you're not essentially a nature lover, because she finds a connection between her own grief. It's a book about grief and a book about optimism, how you get through those difficult moments in your life. And finally, for a complete work of fiction, Anthony Dow, All the Light We Cannot See, set at the beginning of World War II, about a blind young lady who begins to see things differently. And again, another great piece of lyrical writing. So there we have it for everybody, a piece of philosophy, a thriller, a memoir, a piece of history and fiction. And the titles again, The Road to Character by David Brooks, Philip Kerr, The Lady from Zagreb, H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald, and Eric Larson, Dead Wake, the story of the sinking of the Lusitania, and finally, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dow. So support your local bookstore. Don't forget the Berkeley Book Fair, and again, keep me in touch. If you have a good read that you'd like to recommend, I am all ears. That's it from me today. Good to be here, Kevin. Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of Open Air. More great things in our wonderful Bay Area. Things artistic, things musical, things dramatic, things of all sorts to bring you of great interest. Thank you so much for your attention. Neil Swinkles, the best radio producer in all of radio, helped put this all together. I'm Kevin Vance, and I will be your host this time next week. And then David LaTulipe will be back in a fortnight's time. Thank you so much.